This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll be talking to former astronaut Mike Massimino about his long and winding road into space, and to Robert Zubrin about colonizing Mars. But first, earlier this year, the ride-sharing company Uber started offering a $5 flat fare here in Manhattan during commuting hours. Sounds pretty cheap. There is a catch. You're carpooling with other riders, which means you have to stop along the way to pick up and drop off other commuters. Could this be the future of commuting? And how does it stack up to the New York City standard, the subway? Our producer, Christopher Intagliata, tried it out one morning this week, dialing up the Uber app at 9:30 a.m. for his daily commute.
I usually take the subway to work, but today I'm going to try Uber Pool Commute. They have a $5 flat fare. Dialing up the app here, find best pickup, and it says it's going to take 36 minutes for me to get to work. Let's do it. Robert in an Acura is coming to pick me up on the southeast corner of Madison Street. So if I were taking the subway right now, I would definitely make it to work around 10 a.m. It's giving me an update. It says we're leaving in 3 minutes. I think that's him. Good morning.
Hello there. How's it going?
Having a good morning?
So far, so good.
Usually there's a packed car, 3-4 at least.
You take it every day?
Yeah, pretty much for the commute hours. Alex. A-L-E-X, Alex.
And you live here in New York?
Yeah, Lower East Side, born and raised. Yeah.
So it says it's going to take 20 minutes to get to work now.
Just bear in mind, if you have a meeting to make it, you got to take the transit. This does take a while.
Oh, it looks like we've added a pickup here.
Hello, Robert speaking.
Hi, this is Samantha. What is it, Uber?
It's kind of exciting.
I'm on. Until you got to be somewhere in 5 minutes.
Samantha?
It's officially a party.
I don't know how we're going to fit, but...
Yeah, Samantha, I'm from the Lower East Side.
This is your first Uber pool?
Yeah.
Oh, you should definitely be up in this.
It's taking a little longer than I thought.
Mass transit is much faster. Just too many people.
Yeah.
So we're now 4 people. 30 minutes. So that should get me to work around 10:20.
What time did you think you were going to get to work?
Maybe around 10:05.
Yeah, say about 15, 20 minutes. Yeah, that's about right.
This is me, right?
Dropping off Samantha. Bye, Samantha.
Bye, guys. Have a good day.
Have a safe trip.
Thank you, Robert.
15 minutes away.
I think the longest ever from work back to where we got picked up, an hour and 15 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, what can you do? Every other block drop off, another guy picked up, we gotta go backwards. Hey Robert, thank you so much for the ride, man. Alright, thank you guys.
So it's just me and one other passenger and Robert now. It says 1 minute left and it's 10:23, so Uber doesn't lie. Thanks for the ride, have a nice day.
You too, take care now.
And just walking down Fifth Avenue. Drops you off sorta nearby, so you still have to walk a little bit to get to work. Door to door, 50 minutes to get here. So about twice as long as my commute on the subway, but it was very pleasant and I got to meet Alex, Samantha, and Robert. Oh, I almost forgot. Gotta give Robert 5 stars.
Can't forget the stars. Christopher Intagliata taking a trip on Uber for us. So is Uber or Juno or Lyft the wave, or should I say the ride, of the future? That's what we're going to be talking about with Priya Anand, transportation reporter at BuzzFeed News in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday, Priya.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. David A. King, assistant professor of urban planning at Arizona State University in Tempe. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Priya, Uber has been striking deals with cities and towns left and right to become a subsidized alternative to public transit. Is this the future?
That's right. As recently as Monday, they sealed a deal with Summit, New Jersey. It's this bedroom community in New York, a 45-minute train outside of the city. And what they're doing there is interesting because they're sort of replacing a parking lot. They had this huge parking congestion issue. And now the city is just subsidizing Uber rides and saying, you know, if you don't want to park your car in the lot, if it's annoying for you to circle around for parking for 15 minutes every morning, take Uber instead. It'll cost the same amount as parking. So they are striking these deals left and right. And what remains to be seen is how far this can spread into the suburbs outside of major cities. But partnerships that they've launched do provide sort of a glimpse into what the future of our commute could look like.
So instead of building a new parking lot, they'll say, hey, we'll subsidize your ride. to get to the park, to get to the train station.
Yeah, so Summit did the math. Their city manager realized that, okay, you know what? It'll cost about $10 million to build a new parking lot. But if we subsidize Uber rides for about 100 people, which for them makes a significant dent in the congestion around the train station, and with the caveat that, you know, if you build a parking lot, you're not building for just 100 people. You're adding an extra room just in case. They realized that subsidizing Uber instead would cost them less than $200,000 annually.
Wow.
Building a parking lot, A, is not a short-term solution, right? If you decide you're going to build a parking lot, it's not going to crop up overnight. You have to deal with the whole process of actually making that happen. And you have to find the land to make it happen near the train station. And they were like, well, we don't even have the land in the first place. So what do we do if we, A, this won't fix it overnight. B, right. We don't have a place to put this thing that's convenient. So instead, they decided we'll subsidize Uber. We'll do a 6-month pilot program. If it works and people like it, we'll keep doing it. And they could do this for like 50 years and have it cost not right. the same amount as the parking lot.
Now, David, now services like Uber, when you share ride with them, they don't pick you right up at the spot. They make you go to a certain point to get picked up along with other passengers. Isn't this what we would call in another lifetime a bus stop?
In many ways, it is. As the story that Chris told earlier, one of the problems with these types of shared rides is what we call dwell time. And that's every time you pick up a passenger, you add a few minutes to the ride. And the idea that we're going to take people and we're going to put them in vans of 5 or 7 or 10 people, and each of those people takes 2 to 3 minutes to pick up, that all of a sudden is going to add 20 to 30 minutes to your commute. That's going to be a real problem. And so buses get around this by consolidating everybody at stops, and then everybody gets on and off at the same place. So getting to and from the stop is your problem, and then moving between stops is the transit agency's problem. So in many ways, it does resemble a bus because that's the most efficient use of the street space.
Mm-hmm. And Priya, is this technological fix really a good solution for everybody, considering that many people who ride transit may not have credit cards or smartphones or data plans? Things like that.
Well, let's talk about the bus thing again real fast. So Summit actually had explored the bus option before, and what they found is because they're more suburban, it's, you know, North Jersey, everyone's got a car, multi-car garage, they had an issue where if they had a bus system, they realized people would still need to take something to get to a bus stop, right? Whereas
right.
Uber will pick you up in front of your door. That said, Uber is working on a solution where, you know, they can eventually have a dispatch system online and people can dispatch rides for other people to eliminate that sort of credit card problem. And people have talked about in the future at some point, potentially maybe you can pay for these things using your Metro card and things like that.
Yeah, you're already carrying a Metro card to take it to the bus. Why not just have a little Metro card reader on in the Uber like you have them on the buses
mm-hmm.
to swipe the card? David, what about the environmental angle? Well, this idea, ride sharing as an alternative to mass transit, is it, you know, is that like going backwards, putting more cars on the road instead of less cars, instead of taking the subway, you know?
Well, so thinking about the bus in an urban context, like the story that began the segment, and thinking about a suburban rail station, those are two very different markets, and they're going to be two very different solutions. In the context of Summit, one of the ways to interpret what Summit is doing is that they're so scared of raising the price of parking that they're subsidizing more people. They could solve their parking demand problem by raising the cost, which is what we should be doing, and raise the overall cost of driving. So then people will start shifting to mass transit, and these types of rideshare systems will look more attractive because you'll be able to reduce that cost a little bit. As far as the environmental impact, it really depends. Right now, if you have a peak load issue, a peak hour issue, where you have a lot of demand for one-way trips to a train station before the train leaves. So if you have a taxi that brings somebody to the station and then they leave empty, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're saving any fuel or you're saving any road space. All you've done is you've increased one trip to two trips, one coming and one going. So the environmental cost will really have to be seen after these pilot projects are go on for a while. And I say this as a strong supporter of trying these types of pilot projects out. Will they work? I don't know. One issue on the credit card, 10% of the households in New York City don't have access to a bank account. And the MTA has data on their Metro cards. And the people who don't have access to a bank account and the lower income people, they're not buying unlimited Metro cards. They don't have the extra money on their cards to spend on other modes. So there's a lot of equity issues that are also tied up in this.
How will the self-driving car, which does away with the driver altogether, going to impact having this ride sharing? Are we going to just have a lot of empty cars running around picking people up?
My view on the self-driving cars is how much they actually increase driving really depends on how we charge them for road space. And I am a strong advocate that self-driving cars need to be charged for road space, whether they're occupied or whether they're empty. We generally don't like road tolls. Now they're politically unpopular. But I think that we will enjoy road tolls a little bit more when we're taxing a vehicle that's empty. You know, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that robot behind the tree type of a thing. Mm-hmm. I think that will be a way that we'll be able to control the total amount of cars that are driving around our roads.
And Priya, one quick question. Will it get cheaper then if we have these driverless cars?
Many do believe that the cost of labor is the biggest barrier here with ride sharing and ride hailing. So, Uber is working on self-driving cars for a reason, right? Because if they don't, other people will bring the cost of that service down so much that they'll have no choice but to do the same anyway.
Mm-hmm. We've run out of time. I want to thank both of you, Priya Anand, transportation reporter at BuzzFeed News in San Francisco, David King, assistant professor of urban planning at Arizona State University in Tempe. Thank you both for joining us today. You're welcome. After the break, former astronaut Mike Massimino is going to join us to talk about his sometimes terrifying journey to becoming a shuttle astronaut. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. My next guest is a Long Island native who was 7 years old in 1969. That year, there were two major events in his life that happened that would change his life forever. One was a group of underdogs did the impossible. The amazing Mets won their first World Series. That was his team, and I have to admit it's my team, too. And earlier that year, there was another first. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin emerged from Apollo 11 and were the first people to set foot on the moon. And I'm going to let my guest tell us which of those events was more influential on his life. His new book, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe, written by former astronaut Mike Massimino, tells us how he went from the suburbs of Long Island to being part of the two shuttle missions that repaired the Hubble Space Telescope. And it was a bit of a bumpy, sometimes scary journey. Mike, welcome to Science Friday. Welcome back.
It's great to be back, and it's great to see you again.
I never realized that we grew up a block from one another.
One
went to the
block.
Same high school.
Where did you go to elementary school? Did you go to John Street?
Or did. I went to John
Street. That's where I went. John Street School. And we made the same walk. What were you close to Hempstead Turnpike or away from it?
I was four blocks.
Oh, have you listened to Stop Listening already? You were four blocks in. I was right by the turnpike.
You buy the library and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, Lincoln Road Library. And it's supposed to rename the street after me, apparently.
You get that?
It might be a gag, but that's what they're planning to do in a couple weeks here. So I'm excited about that.
And you had Joe Fontana for math, I understand.
Joe Fontana for math, in 11th grade. And Mr. Sforza in 12th grade, and I can remember all of them, back in Cary High School.
Well, now that we've bored the whole audience.
Yes, now that they're all stopped listening, let's talk about going to Pat's Farm for vegetables. Go ahead.
Well, one thing I did see when I was over at the Intrepid Sea Air and Space Museum, I saw home plate from Shea Stadium that you brought into space on the shuttle.
I did, I'm a huge Mets fan, as you say, and I'm glad you forgot the question you said you were going to ask me, because I don't want to answer it. It's a tie between the two, between the Mets winning the World Series and Neil Armstrong walking on the moon.
But the
advantage
to
Neil Armstrong.
Oh, yeah. How did you get the plate up on this?
You know, I wanted to fly something. I flew a jersey the first flight, and then I wanted to fly something. They were closing Shea Stadium down in 2008, which is when we were supposed to launch, but we ended up launching in 2009. And a friend of mine was flying dirt for the New York Yankees, because they were also closing down. Yankee Stadium.
You can't
and
let
so,
that happen.
No, well, dirt from the pitcher's mound. So I called up my friends at the Mets, and I said, did you hear about this guy flying dirt for the Yankees? And he said, yeah, Mike, we can do better than dirt. How about home plate? I was like, send it on.
Wow.
Yep, so that's how it happened.
Wow, and you wanted to be an astronaut since you were a kid. Right.
Since I was 6 years old, I right around the corner from you, when those guys were on the moon, I went outside in the backyard and looked up and imagined that there were people there, and it struck me that it was the most important thing going on, and it was the most important thing that was going to happen in hundreds of years. It grabbed my soul, it grabbed my heart, and it never let go.
And it was not an easy journey.
Your no, it wasn't.
About it.
No, you know, our neighborhood, we didn't see many astronauts walking around it. Did you? I didn't see anybody.
A lot of ice cream trucks.
Ice cream trucks you had to chase. But I, you know, I kind of forgot about that dream. It just seemed impossible. It was like growing up to be Spider-Man, you know, which I mentioned in my book. It was just something I couldn't imagine happening. And I gave up on it. I didn't think about it very much until after college. And then after college, I started thinking about more and more about what was really my passion in life. And, you know, the Mets by that point, playing for the Mets was not a possibility. That became pretty evident in about the seventh grade. But I started thinking about maybe if I couldn't become an astronaut, why not do something to help the space program and maybe try to become an astronaut? Those things I could do, at least try. Cool. And so that's what I decided to do.
And you talk about discover. One of the things I can relate to also in your book is about your fear of heights.
Yes, I don't like heights at all.
Going into space with a fear of heights.
Correct.
How do you overcome that?
Well, you just, but really a fear of heights is like looking over the ledge, you know, looking over a ledge you get the urge maybe to, you know, something's going to happen and you get, but it's your mind playing tricks on you, sort of. I mean, but not really, because if you jumped, you'd get hurt, right?
Right.
But, or if you fell, you'd get hurt. But it's a reference to that distance below you, a couple stories, maybe looking over a handrail that gives you free space like that. That's a danger. In space, like in an airplane, I don't know if you do, but I don't feel a problem looking over out of the window of an airplane or outside of the cockpit. It's fine. And there are many fighter pilots I've met with the same thing, or at least one I know very well, a fighter pilot, test pilot, astronaut commander, a shuttle commander, who is more fearful than I am of heights, but fine with jumping out of an airplane, fine with flying an airplane. And in space, it's the same thing. Your relative distance of the Earth is so far that you don't feel, I didn't feel like I was going to fall.
Right.
So I was fine with that.
I am
really afraid of heights. I am not a thrill seeker at all. I'm the opposite of a thrill seeker.
When I was taking flying lessons, the first 500 feet was the worst part.
Once you get up there, altitude is your friend, but that's also a safety precaution, right? Altitude is your friend. Power altitude. Don't forget that when you're flying.
No, I'm not forgetting that. You became an astronaut, but you were rejected three times because of your eyes.
Yeah, I couldn't see neither. That was another thing.
You know, details.
Yes, I couldn't see. Yeah, that was another problem.
But you didn't let that get to you.
No,
you were going to find a way around.
Well, it disappointed me, you know. And sometimes things become inconvenient. Let's put it that way. They're inconveniences. It would have been a lot easier if I was able to pass that eye test. But even so, even if I could pass the eye test, I didn't know that I would ever get selected because it's still so competitive to get there. There's so many good qualified people in so few spots.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened to me is the first two times I pretty much got an outright rejection from NASA in the first selections, a couple years in between. A few years after that, they were looking for astronauts again. I got an interview. And during the interview, they test your medical situation from head to toe, and including an eye exam. And I failed the eye exam and was medically disqualified. And I thought about it, and I was like, well, you know, what am I going to do? Am I just going to accept that? Or am I going to, even if I could rectify it somehow, which seemed impossible, still no guarantees of anything.
Yeah.
But before it could even be considered again, I had to do that. So I went through some vision training to improve my eyes so I could see better. And it worked.
Wow. Do you think that that stick-to-itiveness is what helped you? They notice that you weren't going to take no for an answer?
I don't know. I don't know if that was it or not, but certainly perseverance doesn't hurt. And I don't know if they notice it. I think they probably see that in a lot of people.
Mm.
But I think that certainly is one thing. I think it's really important to be resilient in life no matter what you want to do. And that's why I think it's important to do something that you really love. Because the thought of being able to do something you really love, even if it's impossible, and I thought being an astronaut was impossible for many reasons, mm-hmm. just the sheer odds against it, even if I had a clean bill of health and everything was good. But because I wanted it so much, it was, I realized, as when I started pursuing it, I realized that it was the perfect job for me. It was the greatest job ever invented. And I also realized that it was impossible to get this job. It was going to be really difficult because I needed to apply, and it was so many people that wanted to do it that the odds were so stacked against me, it was impossible. But I also knew that the odds would be zero if I didn't try, mm-hmm. and I had to give it a shot. And it was in some ways it was easy to continue. It would have been much harder for me to give up. I could not stand the thought of giving up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had the right stuff. I want to explain. You were on two missions to fix the Hubble Space Telescope, and on one of these, you ran into a problem where there was a strip bolt.
Yes.
And now, of course, that's frustrating when you're in the driveway.
Right.
But what's it like up there in space? Did you use the brute force method that we do in the car?
That's what we ended up doing, yes. In fact, I learned that lesson, Ira, on that street right around the corner from you on Commonwealth Street. My Uncle Frank lived right across the street.
Yeah.
And I was about 10 years old throwing a ball against the stoop, like we used to do back then.
Stoop ball.
Yep. And he comes over covered in oil, and he talks to my father. He goes, "Where's your father?" And I go, "He's in the house." He goes in there, and they come back out with a gigantic screwdriver. My father grew up on a farm, and he had these tools from the farm. I guess it was a tractor screwdriver that was like 3 feet long. It was the biggest screwdriver I've ever seen in my life. And he goes, my father says to me, unknowingly, well, how this was going to help me later on in life, "Come across the street with me. Maybe you'll learn something," right? So I go across the street, and the Ford Torino has the hood open. There's there's oil everywhere, and my uncle's covered with grease. And they hammer this big screwdriver to get leverage. This is a science show, after all, right? So he gets some leverage. He hammers this thing into the oil filter. My father steps aside, and my uncle yanks on it and says things that I can't repeat on your show now, and he finally gets it to break. And the solution they gave me to remove that handrail that I describe in detail in the book, but the short of it is that the suggestion was, let's see if Mike can just rip this thing off. And floating, 350 miles above the Earth, working on this billion-dollar telescope, all this high-tech stuff, the thought that went through my head was, this one's for you, Uncle Frank. Going right back there to Franklin Square out on the street. And I just gave it a couple tugs, and yank, it came right off, just like that oil filter came loose.
Wow, that is a good practice.
That's it.
Yeah, you use what you know.
Pay attention, kids. You never know what you might learn. You know, 40 years later or so, it came in handy for me.
You also say in your book that all that training can't prepare you for the emotions you feel in space. There's something I'm not supposed to see, you were saying.
Yeah, the Earth, there are no words. Words do not exist to describe the beauty of what your eyes see when you're in space. They just don't exist. Awesome, beautiful. So there's no way to do that. So I try to describe it in the book, and when I talk about it, as the emotions of what was going through my mind. And when I really looked at it from the spacewalk, from Hubble, the altitude of Hubble, 100 miles higher than a station, you see the curve of the planet. And when I had time to look from the spacewalk, where you're not confined by the window, you can look anywhere you want. You can see the curvature of the Earth, and it's so magnificent. My initial reaction was, this is a secret. We are not, humans are not supposed to see it. It's more beautiful. It's more beautiful than human eyes can handle. I cannot handle it.
It's like a spiritual moment.
It was spiritual. And then I started getting a little overwhelmed and started to tear up, which was going to cause another problem. Water in the spacesuit is not a good idea either. So I had to get myself under control. And then the third time I looked, and this is all within moments, I looked and I thought to myself, the thought that went through my mind was, if you were in heaven, this is the view from heaven. This is the view from heaven. And then I was like, no, it's more beautiful than that. This is what heaven must look like.
Wow.
I really felt like I was looking into heaven, looking into paradise. That was the emotion I had that words really can't describe, but that's the emotion I was going through at that time.
In my end of the block, we call that verklempt.
All right.
Now, I know you were close to the crew that was on the 2003 Columbia shuttle that didn't make it back. Did that change your view at all about going into space?
As far as like the danger, no.
Yeah.
It really did. It was amazing, actually, because I was kind of wondering how I would react to something like that if it happened. You never really think about it. But after it happened, it really didn't add any new information, Ira. It was just like we knew this could happen. You know, there's going to be space accidents, and there's going to be more of them. This is, we haven't seen the last of them. This is dangerous business, and we're going to see more in the future. We mm-hmm. don't know when that is, and hopefully it'll never happen, but the likelihood is there. And it really didn't add anything. It was very sad. It made me think about, you know, losing my friends. Like, it was the worst day of my life, losing my 7 friends that one day. And then the other part of it was, we started thinking, was, well, what happens to our space program? Yeah. We also lost our spaceship. So it was a time of grief and a time of a bit of confusion, but it also gave us the resolve to continue. We were not going to give up. And we figured out a way to keep flying the shuttle. We figured out a way to go back to Hubble, finish building the space station, service Hubble Space Telescope one more time, do that without incident, put the shuttles in museums where they are now.
Talking with Mike Massimino, who is an astronaut and author of Spaceman, an Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. From Science Friday on PRI Public Radio International. Did you know how good a writer you were when you were in Cary High School, that you were writing, this is a greatly written, very nicely
written? Some of my teachers always thought I was a pretty good English student, but I also had help on this. I had Tanner Colby. I had a co-writer with me and a very good editor at Crown, Kevin Doughton. I've always been good. I think the advantage I had is I've been good at telling stories, and I can remember almost everything. I really
can't. It's hard to judge that you like to tell stories.
I love telling stories, and I love sharing it. And so it was a good mix, because Tanner was good at listening and you know, formulating the story. And then I was pretty good at adding to it, I think. And then when we got to the editing stage, we had a very good editor. So my strength was more in the storytelling, I think, and my memory.
Are you going to do a John Glenn and go back up into space?
I would love to, but that was John Glenn. You know, it wasn't Mike. You know, that's a little bit. We're on now, right?
Are we talking again?
Okay, sorry. All right, I thought we took a break there for a minute.
Oh, no.
No, yeah, no. That was John Glenn, okay? I don't think they're going to make an exception for me.
You probably spent more time in space than John Glenn.
I have spent more time in space, but let me tell you something, Ira. That's John Glenn. Okay, he wrote a blurb in the back of my book.
All right, but you know how you could top that? You could go to Mars, right?
Yeah, but I don't know if there'll be, okay, Mike, we've had enough of you. No, I would love to go back. I think that, in my mind, I think I will go back. I cannot stand the thought of not going back. It's not going to, you know, NASA has younger people, but actually not younger. Some of my friends are still older than I am who are going. But I, you know, that chapter is closed, and I'm happy with the way it happened for me at NASA. But looking forward, you know, I think these commercial companies, these private companies, pose great opportunities for people to experience space flight. And I hope I get a chance maybe to travel that one last time. I cannot live on this planet without thinking I'm not going to get another chance to leave it. And so I hope other people don't want to go feel the same way, because I think there's going to be opportunities.
You would not take a one-way trip.
No, I'm not going. No. I'm coming back. When I got my travel orders, you know, it's a government operation, NASA. And when you go somewhere, wherever it is, we would get travelers from Houston, Texas to Baltimore, Maryland, and return. You know, that was our travel orders for that trip, let's say. And we got them at the Kennedy Space Center. They handed them out to us from Kennedy Space Center, Florida, to low Earth orbit and return. And I was really happy to see "and return" in those travel orders. I wanted to come back, and that's what I would feel the same way with another trip.
Last question. There's so few astronauts now left. You had a large class. There are only like 8?
Well, no, there's more than 8. There's 8 in the latest class.
Yes.
But no, they still have probably around 50 or so active astronauts. In the shuttle days, we were up around 140 total. The latest class was only 8, but I think the future classes are going to grow. As we get the capability with these private companies to send more people into space, it's going to be not just private citizens, it's going to be astronauts. I think that number is going to go up.
And for all the budding astronauts out there, what's the one thing message you have to tell them?
Whether you're a budding astronaut, a budding scientist, engineer, teacher, radio host, whatever it is, do what's passionate to you. Do what's important to you. Be honest with yourself. And if it seems like it's impossible, remember my story, okay? Remember my story. It was impossible. It can happen. Don't give up. Give it a try. And that, I think, is the best thing you can do to lead a happy life.
And it's a great story. And if you want to read it, it's called Spaceman, an Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe, Mike Massimino. Once an astronaut, never a former astronaut.
You get above 50 miles, you're an astronaut. Don't let anybody take that away from you, kids.
There you go. All UX-15 pilots are going to hit that.
That's it. That's right.
So thank you, Mike. Stay with us. We're going to be right back and have Robert Zuber. I'm going to talk about going to Mars. We talked with Mike about it. We're going to talk with Mr. Zubrin, Robert Zubrin will be here to talk about it. I'm so verklempt about this. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about space travel, and we are going to talk about what it's like to go to Mars. You know, maybe you've thought about going to Mars. You saw this week where Elon Musk outlined his ideas about sending humans to Mars, and not just to visit, but to colonize. He wants to put 1 million people on Mars to form a self-sustaining civilization there and make, quote, humans a multi-planetary species. Well, my next guest is no newcomer to this idea. He has been plotting for years how the humans could settle Mars. Robert Zubrin is founder and president of the Mars Society, also president of Pioneer Astronautics, an aerospace R&D company. He joins us from Colorado Public Radio Studios in Denver. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. You've been thinking about what? How many years have you been thinking about settling Mars?
Well, I've been thinking about settling Mars since about 1957, but I've been working on it professionally for about 30 years.
Wow. And what do you think of Elon Musk's proposal? Did he get it right? Did he get it wrong? What's the good and the bad?
Well, there were a lot of useful and interesting ideas in his mission plan, but he didn't put them together right. That is, the architecture that he showed was suboptimal. For example, he's got a two-stage vehicle that goes to orbit. The first stage is reusable, comes back to Earth. That's great, and SpaceX is demonstrating it now. The second stage goes to orbit, where it is refueled. Now, this is a very large vehicle. It is about four times the takeoff thrust of a Saturn V, so it's like a Saturn 20, and the upper stage is like a Saturn V. And he refuels that on orbit and then shoots it all the way from low Earth orbit to the surface of Mars, where it is carrying a very large passenger compartment, which stays on the ship. He unloads the passengers, then he refuels this ship and shoots it back to Earth. So what you have is this giant spaceship that you're refueling to send back to Earth, which is delivering hardly any payload permanently to Mars. The engines on this upper stage weigh 60 tons. That could be 60 tons of payload. What he needs to do is the following. First of all, that upper stage, he can reuse it in the way he says, but he should stage off of it just before Earth escape. So it would loop out about as far as the moon and come back and be back in low Earth orbit in a week instead of in 2.5 years. So it could be used five times every Mars launch window, which occurs every 2 years, instead of once every 4 years. You get much more use out of it, get 10 times as much use out of it, and you don't have to drag that heavy stage all the way to Mars and back. And then the big habitat that you shoot to Mars, you don't send it back to Earth. What goes to Mars should stay on Mars. You should unload that hab. The colonists are going to need it. Just keep a small cabin on board the ship and shoot that back to Earth with the pilots and maybe a few colonists who want to go home. And if you do it that way, then the fuel-making requirement that you need to do on Mars to shoot the payload back drop by at least a factor of 5, perhaps a factor of 10, putting much lower burden on the base. So these are some modifications. And in fact, the really interesting, though, about the architecture is that if you do it the way I just said, where you can use that upper stage five times per opportunity instead of one time every other opportunity, you're increasing its payload by a factor of 10, which means you could deliver the same payload by reducing the booster size by a factor of 10.
You have thought about this.
Yeah. But just one more thought. Yeah. Right now, that booster delivers 500 tons to orbit. Reduce it by a factor of 10, you're delivering 50 tons to orbit, which is what the Falcon Heavy will actually be able to do next year.
Well, given all these options, how soon do you think, if you were in charge, you could get us to Mars?
Well, if I were in charge,
yeah.
And if Hillary Clinton was to say in the spring of her first term she's committing the nation to send humans to Mars, I could be there before the end of her second term. From a technical point of view, we are much closer today to being able to send humans to Mars than we were to being able to send men to the moon in 1961 when Kennedy started the moon program, and we were there 8 years later.
Because we don't have to create new technology?
We don't have to create as much new technology, that's for sure. I mean, the challenges we mastered going to the moon, developing hydrogen-oxygen rocket engines, multi-stage heavy lift vehicles, in-space life support, spacesuits, orbital rendezvous techniques, in-space navigation techniques, communication systems, soft landing systems, re-entry systems. You could go on and on and on. The whole bag of tricks we developed during Apollo. What we have to do now for the Mars mission is scale a few things up, modify some things, but we're working within a craft that has already been developed. We're advancing a craft instead of creating a craft.
What about once we get to Mars, setting up a colony, growing food, things like that? How much work needs to go into that?
Well, some, certainly. But first of all, I don't think the concept is that we launch 1,000 spaceships and send 100,000 people to Mars each time and rapidly send 1 million people to Mars as fast as we can. That's not how America was settled, for example. We send first 4 people, and they establish a greenhouse. And then we send 6 people, and then 10 people, and then 20 people, because as you go, you're building up the infrastructure on the ground to support larger and larger number of people. So the task before us in our generation right now is first to send that first exploratory human expeditions to the surface of Mars. And I can talk in a minute about some of the things they can do besides preparing the way for colonists, scientific things. But then perhaps 10 years after the first landing, start establishing a permanent base, which will be more devoted towards developing the technologies that make Martian raw materials into resources for settlement.
Do you think anybody has a leg up on this? Do you think NASA's going to get there first, or is it going to be Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, or who's going to get there, do you think? Who would you like to go with? Place your bets.
I would like to go with any of them. Right now, I would say that the Musk organization has a great deal of credibility. It's showing a great deal of determination to want to make this happen. Musk is not using problems as excuses for not going. He attacks them head on. And so that's something. And I don't think that the first SpaceX expedition to Mars is going to go in this giant spaceship. I think that is something for later. That is something for a future. I mean, you know, Columbus didn't sail in the Queen Elizabeth. He sailed in a much smaller ship. I think if they take that architecture that Musk outlined, scale it down by a factor of 10, and do some of the tricks that I mentioned, the SpaceX could have people on Mars by the end of the 2020s.
Let me get one call here, see if we can get a call in before we have to go. Rachel in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Rachel. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there, Ira and Bob. This is Rachel Tillman with the Viking Mars Missions Education Preservation Project. And good to talk to you again, Bob, and nice to be on.
Good to talk to you.
One of the things that I was thinking about in knowing that you were coming onto the show was we have this immense challenge that's not just a scientific challenge but an environmental challenge that specifically relates to missions being, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 years in a necessary lifespan, whereas our political construct is really chunked up into these 4-year bits and pieces. How can you address, Bob, that challenge that we've talked about before in collaborating with lots of different entities, educational entities such as ours, NASA, a global community of providers that will be necessary to make this exploration occur?
All right. Yeah, it takes a village to do this, doesn't it?
Right. Well, as far as NASA's concerned, a number of people have pointed out that it could use a more stable basis for its funding. Okay, and it has occasionally been advanced by various legislators to create a basis for NASA funding that didn't go up and down and sideways every other year and having the rug pulled out from programs halfway through. So that clearly should be done. That would help. I mean, Apollo was successful because we had bipartisan commitment. We had serious commitment by the political class. No one wanted to, I mean, a few people, but by and large, there was very strong support and they carried it all the way across. Although they, once again, they had the advantage that they weren't trying to do it for 30 years. They were doing it over 10. And I think if we want to go to Mars, the next president has to get up and say, we're going to do this within my 2 terms, not we're going to do it in 30 years. That's leaving too much to chance. Having a private organization to the game can help as well. I mean, look, you know, what Musk is doing and what Bezos is starting to do are developing flight systems. They're developing substantial parts of the Mars hardware set that's needed. And so if the political class starts to address this and they see that half the flight systems have already been developed, that allows us to do this not only at a lower cost, but at a much faster schedule.
Mm-hmm. And, I want to bring on someone who can add to our conversation about talking about what would a trip to Mars be like. Shayna Gifford can give us some ideas. She was a medical officer on NASA's High Seas program. That was a one-year simulated mission to Mars. She's now scientist in residence at the St. Louis Science Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira. Dr. Zubrin, how are you?
Describe this project of what you had six people in one simulated Martian habitat for a year. What was that like?
That's right. Six people, 1,200 square feet. It was like a bunch of scientist farmers. It was like a space camp for real. It was a lot of fun and a lot of challenges and very educational, very worthwhile, and very productive.
And what was the main questions you were trying to answer, or a single question?
The single question. So Dr. Zubrin's addressing the technical aspects of getting there, as is Elon and Jeff Bezos. We're addressing the human aspects of how to get there psychologically, keeping people well, physically keeping people well. We also did some experiments in feeding people, growing food, using volcanic soil and little cyanobacteria. We also cultured food. We exercised. So I'm working on the human part. And Bob and the rest are working on the technical aspect.
There have got to be conflicts that break out when six people are put together for a year and 1,200 square feet.
Sure. Show me a roommate situation where there are no conflicts.
How are they resolved?
Expeditiously, if possible. If not possible, you give yourself an adult timeout. These things are very important, even in space. You know, you can always go out the hatch as needed. You just need 5 minutes to decompress and permission from mission control to take an EVA. If you really need to go for a walk, you take a walk.
So there has to be some downtime allotted to you away from the crowd, some space for that.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, scheduling, how to schedule space time, you know, time in space is a very strange thing because you can never take a break in space. We were at work for 366 days straight, Ira, and that's a problem. Humans need a break. Unfortunately, you still have to get up and water the crops and check the computer system, make sure the air compressors and filters are working. There's no way to take a break at the same time you must. And this is one of these questions we have to answer before we go, even if the technical ones are solved.
Well, for six people, is it possible to scale that up? What it would be like for, you know, thousand, a million people in a Martian colony?
Absolutely. It's possible to scale it up. We were, I believe, at a minimum for our skill set. We had one of everything, one commander soil scientist, one engineer, one architect, one astrobiologist, one physicist, and one physician. It would be tough to scale down and still retain the resources and the talents you need to make the mission run, but you could definitely scale up.
We had Mike Massimino on. Let me just remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. We had astronaut Mike Massimino on talking about what it was like on the shuttle to work. And he said, you know, I discovered, and he writes this in his book, things take so much longer. Missions, things, just turning a bolt, whatever, take so much longer than we thought we would need. Did you find that true?
It's so true. It's incredible, Ira. You spend so much longer cooking and cleaning yourself and mending the clothing and repairing the hab. If you thought owning a house on Earth was a time suck, try owning a house in space. It's that to an order of magnitude. Everything takes longer because half the time you don't have what you need and running to the corner store is not an option. So you either have to science it, you know, or 3D print it or invent it. It's basically very much science on the fly, and everything takes much, much longer.
Robert Zubrin, do you agree that you have to make plans for contingencies you don't expect and bring stuff along that you might not have? Or is 3D printing a great idea, too?
3D printing, bringing extra stuff, bringing people who can adapt, bringing people who can roll with the punch, bringing people who have a sense of humor. We, the Mars Society, we have a simulated HAB too. We have a team in our desert station right now that's going to be there for 80 days and then in the Arctic for 80 days. And one thing, though, that we do find is that having an active program of field exploration completely relieves these pathologies associated with boredom that a lot of simulations that have just looked at isolation have caused in the crew. Mm-hmm. Give them something to do, and they'll be a lot happier.
Have we figured out about the risk from radiation out in space, what to do about that?
We do know quite a bit about that, thanks to Mars Curiosity Rover. We have the reports from the first 200 days. It looks like it's not as bad as it could have been. It's certainly something worth worrying about during big events, worth worrying about, and certainly there's always micrometeorites. There is a little bit of Martian atmosphere, just enough to be a bit of a buffer. But at the end of the day, I think we'll probably be safer and happier living underground on Mars. I know it's very picturesque to put the dome on the surface, but there are huge lava tubes. They provide all kinds of shelter and all kinds of other resources. So that may be where we end up setting up shop.
What about the dangers from on the trip out there? Do you think this is going to be a one-way trip? Because it's, you know, as...
Well, the initial missions, I mean, you could do it one way, but I think the initial missions should be round-trip exploratory missions. Ultimately, we will do one-way missions. Settlement is a one-way mission. I should say, by the way, that the actual health effects that we have seen in space have not been radiological in their origin. They have been caused by zero gravity. And we can counter zero gravity by engineering techniques such as rotating the spacecraft. The radiological effects have been quite secondary and not really noticeable.
Mm. We would like to believe that. I agree that we don't actually know what the long-term health effects are. The cardiovascular state of our poor Apollo astronauts is not good. And we just know that they have not fared as well as their peers. Why? Is it because they were exposed to zero gravity, where 2 liters of your body fluid floats up into your torso and is now pulsing through your heart? Or is it radiation? Or is it something
else?
All right,
we'd have to leave it there because we've run out of time. I want to thank both of you, Shayna Gifford and Dr. Robert Zubrin.
Thank you, Ira.
President of the Mars Society, and she's scientist and resident at the St. Louis Science Center. One last thing before we go. We're proud to announce the launch, speaking of space, of a brand new Science Friday Educator Collaborative. We've worked with educators from around the country to create free educational resources that excite students with cutting-edge science. First up, why do raindrops roll off some leaves and not others? Think about that. Well, the answer you can find out at sciencefriday.com/educate. A really good experiment. We did a Facebook Live on this. Why do raindrops roll off some leaves and not others? Find out at sciencefriday.com/educate. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks always to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.